Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 32nd in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive through questions posed to the participants an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today, we are talking about 21st century dictatorships, and we have Mike Maleski, Sarah Welton, and Charles Hayes with us today. The first question is, since the 20th century is in the record, let's take a quick review of the most notorious 20th century dictators. And I kind of like have a list here of the 21st century dictators, but I'm just going to list a few of the 20th century. Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, Mao, Franco. Everybody in agreement that those are 20th century dictators? So you don't have any disagreement that they are dictators or came to become? Everybody says, that, okay, our panel agrees that those named are dictators. Now, Hitler came to power using lies, intimidation, and agitation to score 33.1% of the November 1932 election, which was enough to get him to chancellor. Stalin came to power by intrigue and political skill. He didn't have an election. No election was required for Stalin to take power. Mussolini, like Hitler, started his own party and maintained party leadership as a vehicle to power. Mao and Franco both came to power as leaders of military rebellions. All of the above chose to identify segments of their citizens as enemies and subsequently murdered tens of thousands of their own people. In the case of Hitler and Stalin, millions of people were murdered in order to protect their own personal power. Is it fair, this is the question now, is it fair to compare this tendency of 20th century dictators to maintain power through murder to our own current crop of 21st century dictators? The use of murder as a way to maintain political power, is that a fair comparison?
Seems right if you consider Saudi Arabia.
Mike, murder as a use to maintain power?
Well, let's ask you a question.
Let's ask the question, though.
You gave a list of 20th century people. Who are you talking about when
we're going to get to the 21st century? All I'm asking you, the question is murder a way in which dictators, with your understanding of dictators, a murder as a utility to maintain power, to get to maintain power?
It's a utility, but I don't have any dictators of the 21st century to
talk
about.
We're not there yet. Give us a minute.
I think that we ought to look at that murder as a tool of power in any place at any time. You've got organized crime. You've got the gangs. You've got all kinds of stuff. I mean, even in Alaska, we have gangs, and there is murder and things attached to that. I don't think that you can talk about power and murder when we're talking globally. It's there. It's there in small communities and large communities.
And there's a very long, long list of people, enemies of Vladimir Putin, who are no longer with us.
Sure.
Who have been murdered.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, now you go ahead and do what you wanted to say. I know you're anxious to do it.
Well, I just found that it was kind of one-sided. We had this 20th century list. But
the first question.
Yeah, I know. But in order to answer the question, I'd kind of like to say move on to the very critical thing of who are the dictators of the 21st century.
That's next. You're segueing me right into that.
I love that.
Okay, let's make a list of who you believe are dictators. We'll talk about whether they qualify based on the definition of dictators that we construct. I have a list here. I have 9 to 10 people on the list. You guys want to come up with who you think? You already mentioned Charles Putin.
Yep.
So we'll go ahead and put a star beside Putin. Anybody else?
Erdogan.
Erdogan, I have him down there. He's our leader of Turkey, currently the leader of Turkey.
Names escape me right now, so you'll have to read your list.
Well, I'm going to let those guys come up with some more, and then I'll finish.
Assad.
Assad of Syria, I have him down.
Orban of Hungary.
Okay, I don't have him down. How do you spell that?
O-R-B-A-N.
O-R-B-A-N. Now, how did he come to power?
Well, he came to power somewhat legitimately with a party, but if you review his present actions, they are definitely ultra-nationalist and I would say qualifies in the categories we're talking.
Okay. Any other ones, you guys, before you want to hear my list?
I said I don't know our South American dictators very well. I don't know their names.
Well, wait a second. How about our friend in North Korea?
Oh,
Kim
yes.
Jong-un?
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
Let's not forget
good.
Him.
My brain is not
okay,
on
okay, what
this.
About Castro in Cuba? Raul. Fidel is, I don't know, is Fidel still alive?
No.
Raul is... aging
figurehead.
Yeah.
Okay, we don't count him then? We're not going to count Raul as a dictator in Cuba? Okay. I'm going to just put a line through his name. How about Maduro, Venezuela? Would you count him as a dictator? No, he's would be more
left-wing. He has just come into a position. We have to see a little bit more of what is going to happen. Although we have a guy that's been around a bit more in the Philippines, of course, Duarte.
Oh, yeah, Duarte.
Duarte.
Very good.
Duarte made the list. How about Xi in China? Would you count him as a dictator?
I find the Chinese to be far more complex. Does he have dictatorial powers, but to what degree is he? For example, if you were to try to compare him to Kim in North Korea, I think they're in different places. But it depends how broadly you want to talk about being a dictator.
I think he has a lot of power, but probably not unlimited power.
Right. Not the same game.
No. As Kim in Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah, who has, we believe,
he's the man. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So we're not going to say Xi. You say he may have dictatorial powers, but they're more limited than, say, somebody like Kim. How about Mohammed bin Salman, the notorious MBS?
I think we took care of Saudi, didn't we?
No.
We didn't say Saudi.
No, we didn't say Saudi yet.
I just mentioned the fact that Khashoggi was killed.
Yeah. Right. So are we going to include him in our list of dictators?
Again,
we're in the 21st century now, Mike.
But with a caveat, because he is still hasn't quite we have the king still there. We still have some limitations. He's the crown prince. He's not the man. So
he could probably be decapitated by relatives.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. So
he has issues yet before he has issues. Say he's absolutely.
He definitely has issues.
And what about Iran?
Okay, I have him listed.
I don't have the name. That's
Rouhani.
My brain doesn't come up with the names.
Well, that's why I did the research and constructed the list.
Good.
Rouhani of Iran, would you consider him a
The list is interesting because I think there's a wider spectrum here than the 20th century. And Iran has some—
These are all 21st century guys.
I know, but the 20th century list that you gave was narrower in terms of being one to another. This list that you're providing is where we're bringing up is much broader, and I think that's a function of the 21st century. It's not as quite as
I think it has more to do with the 20th century guys were way more notorious. Yeah. And historically speaking,
Idi Amin, and you didn't mention him. You didn't mention Papadoc Duvalier. Those are the ones that I'm remembering now that you even got my mind going on that.
Pol Pot.
My folks, yeah, Pol Pot.
Right. Yeah. All those people in Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh was North Vietnam.
Yeah.
I wouldn't consider him.
Yeah,
that's again.
We didn't put him on our original 20th century list. But what about those with dictator tendencies?
I think we can. We don't even need leaders of nations.
We
to
can
have
bring
dictator
that one home.
Tendencies.
How about Trump?
Yeah.
How about Trump?
Whoa.
Does he display?
You're jumping the gun here. We got to get later. We got more questions before we get to that.
Go right to
the heart. Now we have some idea of who we are talking about. We listed some of these 21st century dictators. Let's spend some time on what we are talking about. For example, Assad, Kim, MBS, and Castro all inherited their role from their fathers or brother. While Putin, Xi, Duterte, Erdogan, Rouhani, and Maduro came to power by other means, primarily elections. Is that a significant factor worth considering in defining what is or is not a dictator? How they came to power?
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so.
No,
either.
Power and control is the issue, and whether there's rule of law or whether there is a moral tendency to support human life and growth, and rather than putting down people and
so
and,
what you're saying is whether the person is elected or whether he seizes power through other means or inherits that power based on his family connections, that makes no difference as to whether Charles, you please say
that. It's a well-established strategy of fascism that democracy enables its own undoing. So that's a way to.
So it's easier if you manipulate the democratic process,
right.
Perhaps, but rather than going direct to a military coup. But it doesn't matter.
They're still dictators.
It's a power and control, and it's whether you believe in. In the moral values of human life and growth and health and welfare, over your own needs, power, money,
need for power.
Yeah, there's that, and just the the idea of benevolence, being kind. Taking into account that the times you have to be strong about things, but you work towards a positive finish, a positive goal, an outlook. Like the preamble, Constitution, promote the general welfare, taking care of everybody, and whether your vision is supported by your goals and is supported by your outcomes.
Wouldn't some people think that the general welfare is dependent on whether I am in power because my tremendous abilities of making everybody safe and keeping the economy going is what is really the welfare of the people? For instance, if the economy is doing great and I made the economy great, even though I'm a dictator, but you brought in kindness as well.
Yeah, oh, yes. Know. There's that being kind. There are moral values involved, and looking at the supporting documents of a nation and the supporting goals and outcomes. I feel that when we take a look at liberty, justice for all, when we say the pledge to the flag, do we really mean those words? And I know that a lot of people say, hey, the NFL players that took a knee they aren't patriotic. They weren't taking a knee for patriotism. They were taking a knee for kindness and openness and fairness and support for people who were not white.
So are you saying then that the dictators are void of any kindness?
I I'm not saying they're void of kindness, but kindness takes a back seat to what I can grab for myself and my friends and what my friends can do for me.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Charles?
Say the
repeat. The kindness aspect.
Kindness. It's not on the horizon for them, I don't think.
I'd agree. Okay. I don't.
All right. Consistent with the message of all the above listed dictators, I'm talking about the 21st century dictators, the dictator strongman is the message of national sovereignty, being the main reason they need absolute control. I am in charge because I can protect this nation and all its citizens from foreign enemies. Is the notion of national sovereignty overrated? Is the notion of national sovereignty a danger to world peace? Is it the antithesis to democratic processes?
Well, nationalism is definitely a danger to democracy. This stuff is going on all over the world, and it's when you break it down to the bedrock, it's fundamental tribalism. Raging inequality and too much otherness are causing people to come together, and social media is helping to re-tribalize the world. And
so the notion of national sovereignty, that I'm a citizen of this nation, and that's the most important thing going, this particular nation, it has to be independent and strong.
Yeah, but it doesn't stop there, though. It's not only this nation, but also only my group. Mm-hmm. All those other people over there are the cause for all of our concerns.
You're starting to believe some of the things I was espousing there, Charles. Maybe we're having an impact here.
When I was doing my dissertation, I spent a lot of time on the in-group and the out-group and social psychology, and whether you are a central in the in-group and a mover and a shaker, or whether you're on the margins, or whether you're kind of moving over towards the out-group and someplace in between. This is society. This is the way, you know, a small community is. We have people who are really in the in-group, and then there's people who move out to the outside.
And this is the way all groups actually function.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And are you going to say something there, Charles?
No.
Okay.
It's the way people function. If you want to be a part of that in group, what are the things that you have to do to be a part of it? And there's a lot of people who are on the margins. They really don't know anything about what's really going on inside, but they've taken on the persona of that group because it looks like it's going to protect me. It looks like it's going to be the best for me.
I feel safer in my group.
Yes.
And I'm afraid of the others.
Right. And it's a fear mongering that does occur.
Yeah. Could you expand that to include national sovereignty as far as our feeling safe being in one group and feeling fearful of the other groups?
I think the context matters, and by context I mean timing. If your perception of the pie that's being, of whatever resources, money, et cetera, is being divided, is that there's a lot, and you have a less than dictatorial situation, it's easy to say, let's share. As your perception that the pie is smaller, and there are more people who want to share, there's a changed kind of situation.
Less for me.
And
less for,
yeah. And I think arguably in the 30s in Germany, that was something of the case. And what appears to be an onrushing economic catastrophe worldwide, and including the United States, that's an easy place for people to say, you know, as the pie gets smaller and people want to come in and share it, we got to defend ourselves. That's what I think is happening.
Sure.
With the national sovereignty issue.
And we are this nation. We are the group that is responsible for making sure that nobody else steals our stuff.
Mm-hmm. President Trump's experience as a businessman followed a particular organizational structure. Now, don't laugh at me with this question here. You may see, well, that's the obvious thing, but I'm still going to ask it anyway in an effort to sound neutral. Did that structure, his organizational structure as a businessman, follow a more democratic or dictatorial model? And how did that experience shape the manner in how he governs as president. I'm trying to sound neutral here.
Well, obviously it's a dictatorial. He was the company, and he had very few employees, and he didn't have a board that was telling him what to do.
The whole notion that Trump is a successful businessman is a myth.
Yes.
Totally. And that feeds into fascism big time.
But the organizational structure is right. That as a dictator.
Yes.
As opposed to someone who is
he's surrounded by people like him.
And people who want what he has, want that power. I don't think that he would be willing to listen to a group of stockholders and be, you know, like most organizational boards, the CEO is an employee of that rather than running the whole thing.
In the beginning of the discussion, you wanted to talk about Trump. Here's your chance.
Well, it appears from what we've observed during the early time of the presidency that Trump continues to fire people and that people around him are only there because he says, yes, you can be here, or no, you're going to go. And I think that's a hallmark feature of that uncertainty of whether you're going to have a job tomorrow or a life tomorrow or whatever, if the leader says, I'm going another direction, bye. And I think you've seen, as best I can tell, comparing to other presidents and just that basis, far more of an open door policy that swings both ways and people come in and go out. And my understanding from the early days latter days of Trump with his TV show in particular.
You watched that show?
No.
Me neither.
But I did. I would say I didn't watch the show in the sense that I watched it on a regular basis. But I have seen it. And I obviously there was a hallmark. Once you saw one, you probably had seen most of them. The hallmark feature was a single person who would look in and people would come and say, yeah, here's my pitch. And he would say, no, yes, you're fired, et cetera. So that leads into everything you've been saying. He is the sole determinant.
Yes, but he didn't even write those scripts. Those scripts were written for him.
Right. But they must have appealed to him. He's willing to go ahead and do it because subsequently when Arnold Schwarzenegger ran the show for a bit, he obviously had a script as well, but just couldn't pull it off the same way.
They fed his narcissism totally.
Yeah.
You were going to say something?
Okay. I could go on about other people who try to run businesses or government in that same way and what happens there. It's pretty scary to think, that people who are well qualified for a job are fired because I don't like you, not because they have done something wrong.
So basically that experience of him firing people he didn't like, he's carried that into his role in the way he operates as president.
Well he also suffers paranoia, and a lot of it is well justified because he can't trust the people around him because they're like him.
Why, yes, that's very true. I think that we, it's one of those, we can go into Freud and all of that about how people, operate, based on past experience and based on his own life. He is, I can't trust that person because that person would do exactly what I would do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Dictators, we're talking about dictators now. We haven't really called Trump that yet. But do dictators care about public opinion, or does their absolute power render any concern for what the people think moot?
Oh, I have to say that they care about what the people think to a point. And it's whether they can stir them up. I mean, we see this in the quote-unquote rallies. Instead of going and helping his colleagues in the Republican Party win, through just stumping and saying how great that person is. He's out there telling them what they should, you know, when he says lock her up, when he says, you know, it's it,
does
you know,
that,
you're
that
fired.
Have more to do with the desire for adoration or consolidation of just
It's also, you know, if I've got a buzzword that everybody else will have, make America great again, that kind of thing.
Who's going to pay for the wall?
Yeah, yeah. And build the wall. Build the wall.
But if you look into the historical footage, for example, Hitler or Mussolini, the great examples of an oration in front of thousands of people that are hanging on these words, et cetera. I think that the appearance in front of a large group of people, for that matter, even using a tweet, is designed to elicit a adulation or a response or whatever other kinds of things you have. So by just doing that, it demonstrates that most dictators are very much interested in public opinion because of perhaps an overweening pride in being able to do it.
I'll agree.
What do you think about that, Charles?
I don't have anything to add to it.
So you pretty much agree with what has been spoken about.
Yeah.
Okay, since World War II, America has considered many dictators as close allies. We could start the list with Stalin, but the Shah of Iran, Somoza of Nicaragua, Noriega of Panama, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, our very good buddy, Marcos of the Philippines, Bautista of Cuba before Castro took over, Diem Thieu and Ki of Vietnam, Mubarak of Egypt, most of the kings of Saudi Arabia. That is just a small sampling of dictators that have been our friends. With Trump's good friends being Putin, Kim Jong-un, Duterte, Xi, Erdogan, does it feel any different now with Trump's allegiances with these current dictators? Or is Trump just an extension of the past of American foreign policy being friends with dictators?
To me, it feels so un-American that I can hardly get my mind around it.
I think what you're doing, Paul, is lifting the cover from an era and a time when everything that you've described was happening, but it wasn't as common knowledge. People weren't looking as intensively. So in some respects, I would say this is a continuation of relationships that the U.S. government has had in the past for various purposes.
So maybe Trump's lifted the cover.
I would have to say that I grew up in a very liberal household in the 50s and 60s, and our discussions did take a look at and say, how in the world are we being friends with these people who have done these things? How in the world can we call these people allies? Those discussions happened at my dinner table. Those discussions did happen in my high school social science classes. They were, you know, small groups of people who really didn't have any power to do anything, but we talked about it. We did talk about it. Other things occurred in the last, you know, I mean, I grew up and had kids and all this kind of stuff, and I wasn't really into all of the other things going on, but I kept a hand in to social events and social justice issues and looking at worldwide social justice.
I think human rights is what you're talking
about. Yeah, human rights. Yeah.
Well, we used to deal with dictators big time under the table, so to speak, but we were openly positive about human rights. Now that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other aspect, and it's one that even Vietnam, the torturous history of that area leads you to say, remember that in the Second World War, Japan occupied that area. After the war, it was France that took control, mm-hmm. and there was a colonial aspect to this whole thing. And so when you were looking and you're saying, okay, You have a revolt against the French. You have the U.S. deciding, well, what do we do here? And you have a moment in time often described when Ho Chi Minh was basically saying, you know, I'm trying to get out from under this yoke of colonialism. I have a couple of ways I can go here. Help me out.
And so he was looking at who was going to help him out, whether the United States was more aligned with what the French was doing, and Russia and China were more willing to help achieve independence. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and in part, I can remember some of the discussion about that. There are some great books that have been written about the period. Fire in the Lake is one of them. But it's a long history that just doesn't start at a particular moment in time. And it continues to the point today where we say we see many people who fought in Vietnam, American soldiers, who have returned to Vietnam and have, in one way or another, in some fashion made peace with their history. And also, you know,
John McCain, great example.
I mean, there you go. And then you have a country in Vietnam which is trading with the United States, and where, yes, you can take a trip. You want a vacation? Go to Vietnam. It's not a bad place to go. So how does that, you know, when you look at it and we say, all right, is Vietnam now a dictatorship or not? And for that matter, when we look at China, since many people here from the Valley, I know many people who have made trips to China. And if it were a dictatorship, bad place, don't go there, et cetera, would that be happening? So I think the levels that people operate on the one high level of saying, well, that's a dictatorship, there are certain places you don't go. Perhaps you don't go to Iran, but you do go. People go to Saudi Arabia. People do go to all those lists of countries we've been dealing with.
So the fact that Americans are visiting these particular countries, that has an effect on whether you define those countries as dictatorships or not?
I think it's one factor at work there, because I'm thinking of a place that, Stalin's Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. You know, not a lot of people going to visit just as a tourist.
Unless there's a Miss Universe pageant there.
Well, but that was Russia.
They also had the World Cup soccer games there. And
sure,
those
but we have the modern day Putin in charge, dictatorship, et cetera. It's Russia. Do people travel there? Yes, they do. Not so long ago, we had the Olympics there. So when you look at these kinds of things, you say, okay, it's not black and white. That's a dictatorship. So we don't want to go there because it's going to be a bad place, or we'd be supporting a dictatorship. So individual Americans are making a choice to do this kind of visit, and it makes it difficult to keep clear a pure view of a place as a dictatorship. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, Charles, you said earlier that, I guess the question I asked, I don't want to paraphrase what you said, is it feel different now? Those dictatorships that we supported in the past, we considered allies.
Well, it feels different now. The whole climate in the U.S. feels different. I mean, there are two books that are key to understanding what's going on right now, to my view. One of them is How Fascism Works by Jason Stanley, and the other one is The Road to Unfreedom by Timothy Snyder. Both of them are
24.
Both of them are professors at Yale University, and I've been pretty well read, and I've been reading political science and history for a long, long time. But I'm not used to thinking in terms of fascism. I mean, I'm not used to considering a mythic past, propaganda, anti-intellectualism, unreality, hierarchy, victimhood, law and order, sexual anxiety, appeals to the heartland, dismantling public welfare, and just recently deconstructing the administrative state,
So all those what you just read are lists of examples of a dictatorship?
Fascism.
Fascism.
Fascism, yeah. Right. And Timothy Snyder makes it crystal clear that we are moving in the direction of Russia. Russia got there ahead of us. Russia has a different Russia knows that they can't compete with us on numerous issues. So they're trying to change the subject to virtue. They're trying to make homosexuality a big deal. I mean, it's scary. I just read a book. I can't think of it. It's something to the fact that there is no truth and everything is possible about what's going on in Russia. And it is the most frightening thing you have ever heard in your life. It is surreal. And we're headed in that direction because there is no truth. And we prefer our lies over their lies, you know, in that respect. I mean, it's scary.
So one of the things that I've seen in my research, my observations about dictatorships, fascism, is the ability and the willingness to lie. These leaders, you know, if you read anything about from Hitler's speeches, the lies were just coming enormously. And I'm thinking we're seeing a lot of that right now.
We go back to the book 1984, and I have to say that when I read that as a high schooler, I said that could never happen. Now I'm going, it's happening. It is really happening.
But maybe another reference from the author that Charlie cited, Jason Stanley, was
which is the book you have in front of you right now.
I do. How Fascism Works: The Politics of Us and Them. One of the points that he made that sticks with me has to do with the normalization of something that is absurd. You could call it the lies. You could call it a certain way of behavior that is, at the first glance, first appearance, you say, well, that's ridiculous. But as it's repeated and repeated and repeated and it's made larger, it becomes the new normal. And so
it used to be absurd, but now it's very clear.
Now he's just saying the same thing over and over again, which is a normalization process. And by that, I mean there's an acceptance. There's not a pushback because you're either too tired or in some cases, depending who you are, you begin to believe, well, that's the way it is. And even though it's demonstrably untrue, it could be fact-checked and all the rest of it, but we don't. When we talk about lies, a lie is only a lie when it can be shown to be a lie. If it's stated and no one hears the lie, then it remains as truth.
Agreed.
I mean, you go all the way back to prehistory in tribalism, when no two tribes more or less spoke the same language.
Okay.
There was no truth because only truth was with each tribe. We've almost come full circle. I mean, Timothy Snyder talks about the politics of inevitability. That is, like, if you believe that capitalism brings democracy, that you believe in progress, and if everything is going along, everything's going to get better. It doesn't. But he talks about the politics of eternity, when there is there's a mythic past, there is no future, and all you have is the present. And everybody lies, so
but if we're going back to what the example you gave in prehistory, the idea of truth really wasn't a relevant to what their needs were. Their needs were for survival.
Sure.
They wanted to survive, and
sure.
So that it was the skill set that they brought which allowed them to survive and to
sure, but they developed their own narrative about what was important and what was sacred and what was real, you know?
And that was the mythologies that they
right.
created.
But they didn't need to discuss that with anybody else. They had their own. I mean, you know, and it's we're kind of getting back there.
Getting back where?
To where the only thing that matters is us. I mean, you know, I mean.
Yeah. And that comes down to the cult of personality. It's, you know, to have the adoration, you know, one person wanting adoration and being able to elicit that from others because, you know, you can get what you want.
So I'm just listening to that, Sarah, and I'm wondering, because we've talked about dictators as individuals, but we also have situations that it's not just one person. It's the dictatorship of the proletariat, which is the dictatorship of a group, which is...
Did that really ever manifest, though? The dictatorship of the proletariat was a nice phrase that came out of Marx, but I never really saw any manifestation of that. I mean, we had a Russia, which was supposed to be the ultimate... I'm sorry, the Soviet Union, the ultimate expression of Marx's communism, the dictatorship of the proletariat. But it was really Stalin in charge, or Khrushchev later. And I'm kind of thinking that that just was a nice catchphrase to get all the workers together. But I don't see how that manifested.
Well, I think it might well have post-Stalin. As Stalin passed away rather suddenly.
Hey, hold that thought for a second. This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF. We are here talking about dictatorships with Charles Hayes, Sarah Welton, Mike Molesky. Sorry, Mike. Go ahead.
Well, when he passed away, there's actually a satirical movie, The Death of Stalin, which is worth seeing because...
Is it that Robert Duvall movie? Is that the one you're talking about?
Actually, it's Steve Buscemi playing Khrushchev. Let me just say this. Obviously, a movie, a dramatization, but I think capturing something that we know of what happened when Stalin died, he was a dictator. He was the sole person. But when he went away... there was a group of people that had to work together to make this happen. And out of that came a whole variety of people, Gorbachev, Khrushchev, et cetera, and ultimately back to Putin as a sole dictator. But for a long period of time in there, this place was run by a group of people.
The Politburo, I think they were.
Yeah, you could say, which the manifestation of the dictatorship of the proletariat, whatever. But I think it's important to underline that what we're talking about is something that is an individual who wants to rise up, and no one will challenge that person, and that maybe that's. The defining point. If you reach a situation in a country where one person runs, you got a dictator. Up until that time, you've got all kinds of authoritarian governments, et cetera.
Timothy Snyder talks about that a lot, in the fact that for dictators, the problem is succession.
Right.
Nobody knows what would happen if Putin died.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
We've talked a lot about, rallying the people around and things like this, and we have the fear mongering.
You mentioned cult of personality.
Yeah, cult of personality. Just the idea that this person has all the answers. A local politician not too long ago told me he had all the answers and that I could never teach him anything about education. that he knew it all.
You dumb when, PhD.
I know.
Was he tall?
Yes, he was tall. And so when you have somebody who's like that, who's not willing to listen and learn and pick up information from others, you end up with somebody who says, I have all the answers. And there are a lot of people who don't want to think and don't want to work on the answers, and so they follow them. And when somebody lives crisis to crisis to crisis, like we see in the tweets and Twittering stuff, you've got people who are going along with the crisis, and you end up with a whole society that is, if there's any calm, we have to do something to have a crisis. And this crisis is continuing to create the fear and create that I have all the answers.
So is the creation of the crisis a means to maintain power?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we have calmness, then we don't feel we're alive. There's the other shoe is going to drop, and we have to be prepared for it. It's that if there is any calmness, what can I do to create more fear? That's what I see. That's my personal opinion. I can't, I don't have a study
based
that
on
says
your
that.
Observations.
Yeah, I don't have a study that says that, but I'm going to say that I see that, and I see that in people around the nation. It's just my friends.
So what happens, though, in a circumstance where in the last century we had a drive for world domination that Hitler launched, at the present time, I see a lot of people. We've listed them. But I'm not sure, perhaps Putin, but he's getting some years on him. I don't see one world-dominating dictator. But the interesting question is, how are they all going to play together?
Well, I think the big barrier there is the nuclear bomb. If anyone tries it and starts a nuclear war, there's not going to be much left to dominate. And I believe that Hitler thought that through the conventional war machine, he was going to be able to do that, as well as the Japanese at the time. But I think that ended up being a pretty solid buffer, the bomb. As far as the not having a current person who thinks that they're going to be able to take over the world like the way Hitler did.
Okay.
Do you agree with that or not? Or why are you just – you said there was not – it wasn't happening now.
What I'm thinking is that as each of these dictators does what they do in their own national zone, they already have to bump up against – we have the situation with Kim in North Korea and China. We have people that have to play against one another in some fashion. But my question is, what's their end game? Or is it so short-sighted that it's only about now? They don't see 20 years down. I know we've alluded to a problem with succession or the long view. And I think that with exception of dictators such as perhaps Hitler is the best example, they don't seem to be practicing the art of the long view. What's going to happen 20, 30 years down the road?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the go from crisis to crisis and see, I'll help you out of this crisis and there'll be this other crisis and I will be working on that.
And maybe if the view is so self-focused, you're only interested in what's happening and maybe there's some appreciation that you're not going to live forever.
If you got a world of dictators, they rely on hatred and ethnocentrism so much that it's like having a dry forest and they're playing with matches.
Yeah.
I mean,
Are our constitutional institutions strong enough to withstand any attempts or tendencies which would send America towards a dictatorship?
I don't think so.
So you have fear that our constitutional institutions
I hope they are. I really hope they are. But I have grave doubts.
The movement to have another constitutional convention for the whole United States, and it's been passed in several states.
There's a lot of people afraid of that constitutional convention because of what changing the Constitution as dramatically as a convention would do could lead us to some very serious.
Well, and that's but there's a lot of people who want to do it, and they have pushed for it in many. I mean, I've heard about it here.
We need some amendments rewritten. I think the Second Amendment badly needs rewritten.
In the 1930s, Germany was a very well-educated country, and a minor ideology took place, and it gained power. And gain power and gain power. And that's what happened. When wingnuts gain power, wingnuttery becomes popular.
Like what you were talking about, the normal.
I would say from what we have witnessed recently that most of those assumed methods, constitutional powers, groups, processes are under attack. And they're not necessarily holding up particularly well. The real test will be, I think, I look toward January, as the House of Representatives, which has now picked up a significant amount of power, what it does with that. And to me, that's the testing right there.
Our institutions will be tested with our Democratic House.
Right. Yeah. This is not to say that, for example, as Chief Justice John Roberts recently commented about the president's actions, that he's willing to, and I think he's quite capable of seeing the longer view of.
I think he might turn out to be a swing vote.
Yep, exactly.
Well, he actually was a swing vote with Obamacare.
Yeah,
he was the swing.
Sure. So even if there's been a sense that the Supreme Court is now heavily loaded in one direction or in the other, I still think there are moments coming up. The next year is going to be, I think, the whole game. Really, I don't think looking on toward 2020 and beyond, et cetera. Right now, I think what we see happening in this next year, starting in January, particularly with the Congress and the actions, and whether there's been overreaching on the part of the president, whether there's any that's the time frame I'm looking at.
We are Bridging the Gap on KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. I'm here with Mike Molesky, Sarah Welton, Charles Hayes. We're talking about dictatorships. How much time we got there, boss?
We have 8 minutes left.
Okay. This is going to be the last question, so we can go ahead and expound on that. In 2016, the Democratic nominee for president got 3 million more votes than the Republican candidate. In 2018... despite the fact that less than 10 million people voted than in 2016, 8 million, well, I shouldn't say 8 because my revised number is 9 million more votes were cast for Democratic candidates than Republicans. Are any of you willing to predict what Mr. Trump will do if he loses the 2020 presidential election, especially if he faces criminal liability from the facts revealed by the special prosecutor? Any predictions on what Mr. Trump will do if he loses?
Roll dice, flip a coin, something. I have no idea what he's going to do.
I have no idea, but there's it's a possibility that he will declare a martial law or something like that. And that's a scary kind of thing, that he will just say that it's all illegal and...
Do you fear that may happen?
No, I don't fear it. I just say it's a possibility. The other possibility is that he'll just quietly go away. Is that real? I don't know. I know that, it was that correspondence dinner where he sat quietly after they were digging at him and made some funny jokes about him.
Obama was a funny guy that night.
Yeah, and he couldn't take it. And that's, one of the catalysts for him running. He just sat there, though, during that time. So it could be that he would quietly go away and then come back in some other form.
I think there's a very good chance still that he won't finish this term. I believe when Mueller investigation is through and it's public— he's going to be guilty of enough crimes to spend a couple of consecutive life sentences in Leavenworth. How we're going to handle that, I'm not sure.
Well, you would need 67 senators to convict him to get him out of office, for one thing.
I know.
I'm with Charles. As I've stated earlier, I think 2019 is going to be the defining year. And I think that many of these, reviews, studies, et cetera, will come out. And the sense that I have, given past behavior, is that the president will be not changing. And so he'll be denying. He'll be attacking accusers. He'll be saying things that are demonstrably false.
Which happens on a daily basis.
Right.
Now.
And the real question is, to my mind, and I wonder this, is there anything big enough that he would say that is false that would cause a generalized revulsion in people saying that's over the top? I mean, I've watched things get bigger and bigger in terms of the degree of falsehood and the rest of it. And
what Sarah was saying, the crisis, crises are getting bigger and bigger.
I think the difficulty with the GOP and coming around, I think two or three of them are guilty of collusion themselves.
Well, I have to say that, you know, you asked the question about the 2020 election, and in my head I was going, if he lasts that long. So, you know, I was in there, but I just thought I'd throw it out to that. I am worried about the future, but I'm worried about the future here in the state of Alaska.
What about it?
The considerations of what our future, our governor-elect is saying, and that our governor-elect is very much in the camp of Donald Trump.
The thing that I keep remembering up to the November 2016 results was that Trump kept saying on the campaign trail, this is rigged, this is rigged, it's all rigged. Everything they do is rigged. And that was based on the belief that he was going to lose, because the electoral map at that time had Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Michigan in Hillary's camp. But when they did go to Trump, it wasn't rigged anymore. So I'm wondering if that is going to be the kind of rhetoric we're going to hear at the end of the 2020 election in November 2020.
Could be.
All right. We have 1 minute, so I'm going to let Charles and Sarah and Mike finish up with any comments you have on dictatorships, Mr. Trump, the future of our country.
Well, I don't know what else much to say, but I would highly recommend that people read Jason Stanley's book, How Fascism Works, and Timothy Snyder's The Road to Unfreedom, because we are headed on the road to unfreedom if we don't pay attention.
Book recommendations. Sarah?
Well, I enjoyed the conversation here. I am hoping that cooler heads will prevail and that people will choose to think and vote. Thank you.
Finish this up, Mike.
Oh, it's all about participation. I think what we have noted in this past series of elections has been increased participation, which has changed the dynamic in some races significantly, both here in Alaska as well as nationwide. And I don't think there's anything more powerful than, at least in the foreseeable future, while we still have elections, than vote. And that's what I would leave with.
We don't truly have representative democracy in this country. With gerrymandering and the fact that these small states have the same representation in the Senate that the large states do, it's way out of whack. That needs to be fixed, and I don't know how to fix it.
Well, the House is supposed to be the people's House, that's what we have at this point. So I want to thank Mike, Sarah, and Charles for participating. Great discussion, folks. And all you out there in Radio Land, thanks for listening, and bye. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.